Hi, I'm Steve Calland, and with my wife Leah, you're about to listen to our Insightful Adventures, a show that chronicles our travels around Australia and the savvy, scientific, and scenic things we experience along the way.
So our last three episodes were focused on our time in Tasmania. However, before we landed in Tasmania, we spent some time in Victoria. So this episode and the next two are going to focus on our time in Victoria, just in an effort to make all of our episodes more cohesive. And so we're going to jump back in time this episode and talk about our first 6 days in Victoria. We traveled from the South Australia border to Melbourne, Victoria. And then from Melbourne, we traveled around the metro area and eventually went down to Phillip Island, which is south. And then from Phillip Island, we drove back up to Melbourne to go to the ferry terminal to make our way down to Tasmania. And in those 6 days, we traveled 946 kilometers, or 568 miles. So driving into Melbourne itself was just another perfect example of how Google Maps is not really up to date when it comes to Australia.
No, it isn't at all.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's better than Apple Maps, but Google, at least the algorithm they have working, at least here, is they will take you the shortest distance, which doesn't necessarily mean the fastest or the best route. They just will calculate, oh, this is the shortest distance from A to B.
Yeah, so we were traveling all the way from the South Australia border into Melbourne with the most back roads ever. I mean, it was one lane paved with like soft edges on either side. It was crazy.
And through through farmland with big tractors and diesel
logging trucks. Yeah, it was awful. So anyway, stupid Google Maps in Australia.
Yeah, not like we know where to go or have good maps. It's just like, and the highways here, a major highway is still a two-lane road, so it's not like you can really tell a difference. But Google, they need to update their algorithm.
Yeah.
Anyways, the first real thing we did when we did get to Melbourne was go to the Australian Open.
Oh my gosh, that was a bucket list item that was just never even on my bucket list because it seemed so unfeasible. But we did it.
We did it. Well, any Grand Slam of tennis seems a little infeasible. There's only four, and it's like that's the peak of tennis playing or any one of these Grand Slams.
Yeah, and it was so awesome. We basically planned, before we really hit the road for our trip, we knew where we were going to be for Christmas, and we knew that we were going to be in Melbourne for the Australian Open. And those were the only two dates that we had set before we hit the road. So we've been looking forward to this for a very long time.
Yes, and we only saw round one, and we were in the Margaret Arena. There's like 22 courts in the whole place, but there's two really big arenas. Is the Rod Laver Arena, which where all the super awesome superstars play, and the Margaret Court Arena still has good players, but it's not like your one or two seeds. And so we ended up seeing two matches. We saw a men's and a women's singles match. And the names of the players that we saw.
The female that we saw was Gavrilova, Dasha Gavrilova.
Against Brody.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then for the men, we saw Dimitrov versus some nobody Australian named O'Connell.
Yeah. So Gavrilova won hers in three sets, and
Dimitrov
won his in five sets. And yeah, that was super awesome. Like, they were still, Gavrilova, oh yeah, she was ranked 22, and Dimitrov was 15th, I think. So mm-hmm. Still ranked professional tennis. Leah's super into tennis. I learned so much more about tennis, but
yeah,
it was
Steve,
pretty awesome.
Steve has been learning the scoring of tennis for quite a few years, because he's seen me play tennis several times, and this is the first time it's like fully clicked. The points, the games, the sets, the matches.
It is so confusing. Why do they do that?
And it was exciting too, because Dasha Gavrilova and O'Connell, the nobody, the unranked guy that we saw, they're both from Australia, and so the crowd was really, really supportive of Dasha and of O'Connell, and that was just fun to be in Australia with Australians supporting one of their players.
Yeah, so Dasha made it to the fourth round, which is pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then Dmitrov got out, I think, in the third round.
Yeah, and then we really didn't follow the rest of the Australian Open because we were traveling and in Tasmania and stuff. So we heard later on about the exciting men and women's finals, but we didn't actually get to see any of it.
No. And just so you know, it was Federer and Nadal in the men's singles finals. And Federer beat Nadal in 5 sets, which is a super long, tough game.
Mm-hmm.
And both Federer and Nadal are super awesome players. And then Venus and Serena both played each other for the women's singles. And Serena beat Venus in 2 straight sets.
Yeah. Yeah, which again, I mean, that final lineup for men and women is just such a throwback. You know, the Williams sisters and Nadal and Federer, it hasn't been that way in years. So I wish we could have been around to see it. We wouldn't have been able to afford to go watch it no. in the Rod Laver Arena, but it would have been awesome to watch. But we were doing other awesome things instead, so it's okay.
But it was cool to see peak tennis playing.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah. I posted a picture on my personal Instagram and of us being at the Australian Open, and it got the most likes of anything I've ever posted ever. More than any wombat or koala or beautiful beach. It's like, oh, the Australian Open. That's where all of my followers came out of the woodworks and liked that.
Yeah. And then just some other things about Melbourne. Melbourne is like, I don't know if it's the official or unofficial sports capital of Australia. It's also just has a lot of culture. So Melbourne hosts the Australian Open, the Melbourne Cup, which is horse racing, the Australian Grand Prix, which is Formula One, the Australian Masters of golf, and it's the AFL Grand, hosts the AFL Grand Final, which is Australian Football League, which is Australia's big, huge sport. And if you don't know what it is, just look it up. It is the crazy. We've been here for 2 years and I still do not understand the game.
No, it's like part rugby.
Part rugby, part soccer, part basketball.
Part volleyball. Just the way that they handle their unique footy ball is weird. They'll punt it and they'll kick it and they'll throw it. And they'll tackle. Oh, it's weird.
It is. It's just a crazy game. And so the AFL head office is in Melbourne. And there's 18 teams all over Australia that participate in their Australian Football League. And Melbourne hosts 9 teams. That's half the league.
It's a big deal out here.
But just put it in perspective, that's as if Los Angeles had 16 professional NBA teams.
Yeah, that's unreal. And like the fan base to support that. That's
yeah,
crazy.
It is crazy. Also, Victoria, which slash Melbourne, is kind of accredited for coming up with AFL. And Wikipedia, which we all know how awesome that is, said Melbourne is the spiritual home of AFL and cricket.
Yeah, which is interesting about cricket because I associate more with, you know, Europe and India, so.
Australians love their cricket, too.
Yes, they do. Yeah, they do.
Which is another game that eludes me.
Agreed. Agreed on that one.
So anyway, Melbourne. It's got a lot going on.
Yeah. And just south of Melbourne, there is a town called St. Kilda, and that's after the Australian Open. The next day, we made our way down there in the evening, and they have a penguin parade. And that was an opportunity just within the city of St. Kilda to see their colony of fairy penguins.
Yeah. And it's free to go down to at this St. Kilda, and fairy penguins, they always come in at night. And so depending on how long you want to stay around, they'll kind of just swim up and they'll go to their nests. And fairy penguins are site dependent. Is that what that's called?
I don't know.
Like they always site go back dependent. To the same nests or typically.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I thought you meant like visually site dependent. What is the term? I know what you're talking about because I was the one that used it.
Anyways, they tend to always go back to the same beach or the same nest or same area time and time again.
Yeah, so there has actually been a colony of fairy penguins established in St. Kilda's. They say officially since the 1970s, but really it was more like the 1950s. And the St. Kilda's little penguin colony is... it has the highest survival rate of any of the colonies in Victoria. And that has to do with the supply of food in the bay close to it. I think there's a lot of pilchards and sardines and squid that they eat. But also, didn't the volunteer say something about how there weren't a lot of fox or dogs around? Or there's some other reason why it was the healthiest population?
Yeah, so they, because I think their nests are kind of in the harbor, and so there isn't a lot of, feral cats or foxes around that area because it's kind of protected by a lot of human activity, and there's a lot of boats, and it was kind of out on the pier, so there really wasn't a place for any of their predators to kind of, prey on their nests. And so, yeah.
Yeah, and what's interesting about, so there's fairy penguins, it seems, all over there. Obviously, you heard about our experience with the fairy penguins in Tasmania, but there's also fairy penguins here in Melbourne and in Phillip Island, which is just, just south Victoria. There is a more well-known tourist fairy penguin colony and another penguin parade there. But what's cool about the penguin parade on Phillip Island is that since there are more natural predators around, the fairy penguins will group in large numbers on the shore before they make their way back to their nests because there's safety in numbers. But whereas the St. Kilda's penguin parade, since there's not those natural predators, you'll just get, one or two fairy penguins sort of trickling in as the night goes on. And they wait till night to return to their burrows because there is protection from predators, but at St. Kilda you don't get those crazy large numbers.
Yeah, and we did go down to Phillip Island. We thought we were going to do the fairy penguin parade down there. We ended up not doing it. I think mostly just because it was expensive to do, and they had just... It was just touristy, just very, very done up touristy.
Oh my gosh, they had commercialized it as much as you could commercialize anything.
Yeah, you could get the cheap tickets, which were further down the beach, or you could get really expensive tickets, middle-aged tickets to like get closer, or even more expensive tickets to talk with a volunteer and get really close. But yeah, they just commercialized it to the max, and that's things that Leah and I don't really like to do.
Yeah, but it does have its positive aspect too, because with Phillip Island, their mentality was that they control the humans and let the penguins do their thing, and it just so happens that controlling the humans means charging a lot of money and having you sit in your seats. Whereas in St. Kilda, you can see them much closer, but there are stupid humans around that don't follow the rules that they're supposed to. Like, you're not supposed to use any flash photography, and lights are, you're supposed to use red lights or cover your flashlights in red cellophane. You're obviously not supposed to touch them, even though there were those high guys down there that were touching them. So you do get to see them more up close, but there are really stupid tourists that don't use common sense. And so the penguin colony in Phillip Island is is better protected from humans. So it does have that aspect because it's so touristy.
That is true.
I'll give it that.
But if I think we've seen fairy penguins in Perth as well and in Tasmania. So in my opinion, if you're going to go on a trip specifically to see fairy penguins, I would go to Tasmania to see them because you still got to see them super up close. They were still volunteers around making sure that tourists weren't doing stupid things. And you got to see adults and some little chicks.
Yeah, it was wonderful. That was at the Lilaco Beach Conservation Area just on the north coast of Tasmania. And yeah, of all of our fairy penguin experiences, that was the best one.
Yes. So after that, we went down to Brighton Beach in Melbourne, which is probably one of the most popular tourist beaches in Melbourne. And it's famous because it has these...
bathing boxes.
Yeah.
So what they call them. Yeah, there's 82 Brighton Beach bathing boxes. And it's awesome because they line Brighton Beach and they're all basically uniformly built. And they're small. There's not any like electricity or anything that's run to them, but they're all painted differently, and they're all these little works of art just lining the beach.
They are cool. And what people do is locals or whoever buy them, and they just kind of keep all their beach stuff in these little things. And they're expensive. They're packed on the small little beach, and we were staying at our Airbnb, and our Airbnb host said that the boxes can be over a couple hundred grand.
Do you want to hear how much?
Yes.
So I looked into it. Usually these bathing boxes sell for, you know, more around $200,000. But last year there was one, and this was the latest information I could find. Last year they sold two beach boxes, and there's one that broke the highest record as far as price goes, and it went for $285,000.
Goodness.
Yeah.
These are the size of your backyard
garden shed. Yeah. It's basically a garden shed right on the beach. But it's really cool. They were actually built, the original ones were built over a century ago as a result of this Victorian morality idea that, you know, this is when women were in dresses, you know, covered up ankles and wrists for, to not be too scandalous. And so these bathing boxes, they were popular in Europe as well. And what's cool about the Brighton Beach bathing boxes is that they don't go up for sale very often, but the money that is generated from selling these goes directly back into the community itself. And they do actively build a few new bathing boxes, but they keep it in the same uniform style as the others, and only local residents are allowed to purchase these bathing boxes, which is pretty cool too.
That is cool. I like that they do that.
Yeah, and so they don't go for sale like very often. There was one in the article I was reading, there's one lady that was like, yeah, I bought mine like, you know, 60 years ago for $700 or something like that. And they're saying that the bathing box property appreciates more than the actual just residential property itself.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's cool to see. I mean, the beach is nothing like that spectacular, but you go for the artwork of the bathing boxes more than the beach itself.
Yeah, the beach wasn't that great, but the boxes are cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, worth an afternoon visit. So then the day after that, we finally spent some time, about a day and a half, at Phillip Island.
Yeah, so besides the fairy penguin stuff, we did some other things. We saw our first wild echidna.
Oh my goodness. And do I have some echidna facts for you? I don't mean to talk so much, but we just totally lucked out. There was just an echidna on the side of the road. We pulled over.
Just eating ants and scurrying around. He was not bothered by us at all.
No, not at all. And yeah, there's actually some pretty cool things about echidnas that I learned. So they're monotremes, which are egg-laying mammals, just like platypuses. And what's fun about an echidna is that their babies, do you remember what their babies are called?
Puggles.
Yes, yes, a baby echidna is called a Puggle, which is the cutest name ever. And after about 10 days, so since they lay eggs, they lay a single egg that's sort of leathery and soft, about the size of a dime. And after 10 days of the egg being laid in the pouch, it'll hatch this little smaller than a jelly bean Puggle. And a monotremes, but specifically echidnas, they don't have any nipples. And so they feed their milk through these special glands in their pouch called a milk patch. And they also, echidnas don't have any teeth, but since they eat ants and termites and worms and things that have an exoskeleton, they're able to break down their food with hard pads on the roof of their mouth and on the back of their tongue.
That is so weird.
Yeah, to kind of grind it down, I guess. And then, so echidnas, they kind of, to the untrained eye, they look basically like a little porcupine. But really, they're covered in two types of hair. The long hair are the spikes, which is actually a modified hair. And they're turned into, that is a modified hair that's pokey, and it's used for protection. Then they also are covered in shorter hair that maintains their body temperature, which actually varies quite a lot for a mammal. But the most interesting fact about an echidna is that male echidnas have a four-headed penis.
Why?
I'm not sure.
What, you figured out that they had four heads, but you didn't look up the biological significance of that? The evolutionary?
You know, I don't know if there is an exact consensus as far as...
I'm going to look it up right now.
...what scientists think the reason behind it is. But so they do say that the females have a two-branched reproductive tract. And so whenever the echidna male is having sex, they'll have to use two of the heads for that sexual act. And those will be large and active, and the other two will be smaller. And so since echidnas will mate multiple times within a season, they are thought to sort of switch off between the two heads, you know? So I don't know. I mean, that's not necessarily a reason why, but they need two to have sex with a female echidna. I mean, why they have four, I'm not sure, except obviously there's some advantage to passing on their genes. But the other cool thing is about echidna sperm. So echidna sperm, they form bundles that swim faster than individual sperm cells itself. So the sperm work together in these bundles to go fertilize an echidna female egg.
That's so bizarre. That's like people in the Hunger Games, like, teaming up, but then knowing there's only one winner.
The whole mating thing in echidna sounds weird because there's, like, a whole mating train. There's, like, a female that's just has lines of males behind it that just sort of form this train and try to get to the female, and they push each other out of the way, and it's crazy. Yeah. But that was just, like, a 15-minute detour of one day in Phillip Island. It's really a great place. If you want to spend a lot of money, there's cool things to see and do. You can see koalas. You can see the fairy penguins. There's a trout farm where you can go fish for trout. There's a maze. There's great swimming beaches on the top end of the island. And we just sort of wandered around and made our own adventures, really. So anyways, and after our experience in Phillip Island, we drove all the way back up to Melbourne and boarded the Spirit of Tasmania ferry and hung out in Tasmania for 10 days. So in the last segment of our podcast, each of us share either a personal insight from our travels or a little adventure that wasn't covered earlier. So I'm going to share the insight for this episode. We had a wonderful Airbnb host in Melbourne, and it was mostly the husband that we were able to talk with the most. And he was our age, probably a little bit younger, you know, somewhere in his early 20s. And he has a mentality about life and success that contradicts me and Steve's personal experience. And it really sparked a lot of conversations between Steve and I. And so our Airbnb host, he thoroughly and honestly believes that success in life comes from hard work and optimism. So thinking positive thoughts and working really hard, you will be a successful millionaire one day. And Steve and I completely disagree, basically.
100%. As much as you can disagree with something, we disagree with that.
Yeah, which, because that has just not been our experience. There's actually a great, great quote by George Monbit. And it says, if wealth was the inevitable result of hard work and enterprise, every woman in Africa would be a millionaire.
Yeah, people, I think, wrongly associate success with, oh, it was all my hard work. I did this, I did that. But they don't take into account of where they grew up and what opportunities they had and what their parents did, which were all things out of their control that had nothing to do with their own personal grit.
Yeah, and not only that, but they will then in turn look down on people that aren't able to achieve the success that they do, because they again will just wrongly attribute it all to their own personal hard work. Martin Luther King actually has another great quote, and he says, it's a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And again, that's just, I think, a great way to speak to people that are not even afforded the, it's not a level playing field when you enter this world. And some people are born without shoes, you know, and yet people tell them like, oh, just work hard, you know, and people might work as hard as they possibly can and still never be able to achieve the same success that is just, you know, flippantly give to somebody because they have the right last name or something, you know?
Yeah. And so, and there's hard work that goes into successful people. Just Lee and I's perspective are there's so many things that outside of one's control that goes into your success or not success that have probably a majority factor in what actually happens to you. And our Airbnb host didn't think that. He thought it was all in one's control. And that's not been Lee and I's experience. And nor do we think it's really the experience of majority of people.
Yeah. I don't know if I have time to share this, but I remember a study that I heard about on a Science Friday podcast, and they were basically talking about this same thing. There's a study that was done, and the participants played Monopoly, and some of the participants were given an advantage in Monopoly where they were given either extra rolls or extra money, and whenever they inevitably usually won the game, the researchers would ask them what it was that helped them win the game. And instead of attributing it to the fact that they were given this extra advantage at the beginning of the game, they would say, oh, it was because I had a better strategy, or it was because I, you know, could outwit the other person. You know, it was never, ever attributed. Well, actually, I'm not sure if it was never, ever, but in the study, it was rarely attributed to the luck or the initial advantage. And I think that's just great that they were able to, in a scientific controlled way, sort of show the same thing that Steve and I have noticed in real life.
Anyways, and I have the adventure, and the adventure is at the Australian Open. I had met a couple old missionary friends actually in Melbourne. And one of our friends, she was able to sneak into the Rod Laver Arena, which is the big arena, during one of Serena Williams' early matches. And so the way they do it here in the Australian Open is if you have a ticket, they let you in. But during play, they don't let people in and out. They only let people come in and out of their seats when there's a natural break in gameplay. So, and my friend was able to sneak into Serena's game by waiting outside after like the first set or two. And then as they let people in, she just kind of went in with people in the national break. And so we tried to do that with
Novak Djokovic.
And we waited out, and there was a big crowd, and we tried to do it, but there was like three or four people asking to see our tickets.
Yeah, so even if we would have been able to sneak in that first security person, there was another security person just a few feet away that would have asked again.
Yeah, so we tried to sneak in to see Djokovic. Would have been awesome. But we couldn't, and we got... Which was fine.
They asked for our tickets, and we're like, oh, yeah, let me just pull them up on our phone. And then we just, like, walked away. And then, like, really walked away faster. We're like, okay, we're caught. Abort!
Abort. Yeah. So that's just a small little adventure that we did.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening to this episode. You can catch us on Instagram at Insightful Adventures to see pictures that we've posted from where we currently are or pictures from our episodes. And that's just a great place to see what we're doing and to ask any questions or follow up with us.
Mm-hmm. You can continue to find our episodes on iTunes and on Podomatic. And we have a personal goal to become a new and noteworthy podcast on iTunes. And the way to do that is to have people specifically review us and rate us. It plays into Apple's algorithm. So download, subscribe, rate, and review us. We'd really appreciate it. And we enjoy making this podcast. We just want to have a little bit better exposure.
Yes. So please do that. And thanks for listening.
We'll see you next time.